everyone, welcome to another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you ever wanted to know about sneakers, hosted by me, Jason Coles, and the ever irrepressible Mr. Kish Cash.
I'm glad you said irrepressible, not irritating.
Well, I wouldn't say that, obviously. I know others would, but Kish, you are renowned for having one of the biggest sneaker collections known to man, and where you keep them is some sort of mythical Doctor Who TARDIS-like place. But today, maybe for the first time in your life, you're going to meet someone who's got an even bigger collection than you. Now, strictly speaking, it doesn't belong to her, but we're talking to Elizabeth Semmelhack today, aren't we?
That's right, yeah. She's the senior curator and the creative director for the world-famous Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, the home of the largest collection of shoes and sneakers in the world. It's some place that you and I need to visit, and hopefully we can blag some tickets from her after we've chatted to her and buttered her up. And she's like, yo, you guys are so great. We're going to fly you over once we can get you over. But I'm just absolutely in awe of this woman, because the thing is, she's also, written a couple of books as well. I'm sure she's going to speak to us about them during our conversation. But, she was basically the mastermind behind the groundbreaking exhibition Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture, which happened in the Brooklyn Shoe Museum. And then it toured around the world. It went to, other parts of the US, Australia. Mm-hmm. And, she's also the author of a few books as well. But so, yeah, we should get chatting to her and see what she's saying.
Elizabeth, welcome to the show. We are absolutely honoured to have you on Soulful today, because there is probably no one in the world who knows more about the history of shoes and sneakers than you. Let's go straight into it. So where did this journey with the museum begin for you?
The real story is actually kind of ridiculous. I had done my graduate work in Japanese art history. I was very interested in Japanese print culture in the 18th century. And I was fascinated by basically popular culture, the intersections of popular culture, economics, fashion, and gender. And I was lucky enough to be hired by the St. Louis Art Museum, and I had a great job there. But I grew up outside of Buffalo, New York, which is 2 hours south of Toronto. And my mother, who is an international intellectual properties lawyer, happened to work cross-border. She had an office here in Toronto, an office in Buffalo. And one day in 1999, she went to the Bata Shoe Museum for an event after hours, and Mrs. Bata spoke. And she called me that night and she said, I have found the perfect place for you to work. It's the Bata Shoe Museum. And I was like, Mom, I do Japanese prints. Like, what are you talking about? And she just was like, there's something magical about it. It's a really interesting place. And then just by complete coincidence, about 3 months later, the job of head curator was posted for the museum. And I basically applied to tell my mom I listened to her. And then the next thing I knew, I was being flown up. I have graduate degrees in both Western art history and Asian art history. And I knew nothing about footwear at all. And I have no idea why Mrs. Bata took a chance on me. But I started in 2000, and it has been, it's almost 21 years now. And so I didn't know how many questions I could ask of footwear. And now I know for a fact I will never be able to have all of my questions answered. And I started my first question, which I thought was so innocent, which was why the high heel, has ended up being a 21 year long research project that has taken me to 10th century Persia to show that heels were invented for equestrian purposes, horseback riding. This is why cowboys wear high heels. And it was, in fact, me working on high heels that led me to sneakers.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a mad journey. That's a mad journey. So Bata, right, for the uninitiated, the unfamiliar, what is Bata?
So Bata is a global organization that makes footwear around the world. But we are not a corporate museum, but we share the Bata name because Mrs. Sonia Bata, who until she passed. She, along with her husband, were the heads of the company, and she began to collect footwear when she married at a young age, and she liked to say she married a shoe man. And already the company was, as I mentioned, global. And so Mrs. Bada, in 1949, didn't want to sit back and do nothing. She certainly could have, you know, had nice drinks on the Riviera, but instead what she wanted to do was travel the world with her husband. And she made a very straightforward, but I think profound observation, which was that no matter where she went around the world, people's feet were basically the same, but what they had historically put on them was incredibly different. And so what were the cultural reasons for this? What were the environmental reasons for this? And she began to collect. She began to collect and collect and collect and collect. And then finally in 1995, she had built a specialty museum in downtown Toronto, and we opened our doors in May of 1995. So we're in the midst of celebrating our 25th anniversary, and we have now close to 15,000 artifacts.
15,000. Wow. That's
only slightly more than you, isn't it, Kish?
Just a couple. You know what I mean? Which is quite mad. Did any of Imelda Marcos's collection end up there?
It did.
You know, when everyone talks, oh, it did.
It did. And so, everyone will say, oh, you know, this is rivals Imelda Marcos. And I always counter, Imelda Marcos had a measly 2,000 pairs. So I think we've got that beat, but obviously the reason we're collecting is for much different purposes.
At the time, the idea of a shoe museum, I'm guessing, was pretty novel. I mean, how was it kind of taken at the time? Because, you know, I guess when most people think of museums, they kind of think of natural history museums, science, etc. What did people make of a shoe museum at the time?
When Mrs. Bada proposed to open the museum, I think many people thought of it as such an oddity, instead of understanding that footwear really can be approached in a very academic way, and that by entering cultural or asking cultural questions starting at the footwear level, that can really lead to quite interesting and thoughtful discussions. Or, I mean, I think people have now, maybe for the past decade, realizing that it is a real museum with a real mandate and a very serious collection and serious research going on. So,
yeah, no, totally. Because like shoes for me and sneakers, etc., are design aesthetics. You know, they have a form, they have a function, yet they just, you know, the way that they permeate through society, sometimes subconsciously, but sometimes so overtly consciously, is absolutely fantastic. And with the museum, surely you can inspire the next generation of designers as well, but also people who can go in there and appreciate a pair of shoes in a similar way that they might appreciate a painting.
I think you're right. I think there's so many different ways of approaching a pair of shoes, right? Sometimes it can be just to appreciate the beauty of their construction, their architecture, their aesthetics. Sometimes it can be amazement. I mean, I think that, as Mrs. Bada observed, people's feet through time and around the world have been the same, and yet the contraptions that we put on them are really quite varied. You know, I will often say this in discussing the high heel. The high heel has become so naturalized in Western fashion, but if you came and had never seen a high heel ever before in the history of your culture and your own lived experience, that is a remarkably non-intuitive form of footwear.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
That deserves some investigation. So I think that footwear, it can be appreciated in many different ways. And then also that interest, curiosity, and appreciation can also lead into larger discussions of why a society would want people to wear this type of footwear or would seek out these materials, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, one of the things I think is so interesting about shoes, and we're living in a really interesting moment culturally about privileged culture and thinking about what museums are and what they do. And one of the things I continually say about footwear is that even if you're looking at a shoe designed for an 18th century princess, let's say, the person who made the shoe was middle class, maybe lower working class. The person who did the sericulture to create the silk comes, you know, was probably in China and had their own lived experience. And if you think about all of the different hands, all of the different lived experiences that touched just one single shoe, can actually tell the story of many different societal experiences.
Absolutely.
We do that in our museum, but I think that this is something that many museums would benefit from doing.
Yeah, it's almost like they're anthropological, isn't it? You can sort of like defer and you sort of investigate and discover, the, as you say, the stories and the tapestry behind a mere shoe, but also in terms of society, hierarchy, and everything that's going on, the materials at play, and you can probably date things according to the materials that are used as well and how technology advances.
Absolutely, yeah. Technological advances, global trade, innovations in dyeing techniques, things like that. All of those things. Again, you can find a pair of shoes, and it can take you down so many different paths. And I think that's why I'll never run out of questions.
Oh, that's fantastic. You have a dream job, right? Right, Jason and I would love to do what you do. Yeah, and we're just trying to put you.
Don't
we're
say
trying
that
to put. Oh, no. I think you're pretty good. You're pretty good. But the thing is, it's like, you know, what does an average day involve for you? You know, you get up and, you know, I mean, what goes on?
I think the thing that I love the most about my job is that I literally cannot anticipate what an average day will be, because footwear is worn by everyone and is so wide ranging. I could get a call from a police officer about a Jane Doe trying to figure out when the person may have been killed based on what they're wearing. It can be somebody calling from a news agency about something that was on the runway the day before. Uh-huh. It can be a university calling to ask me to give a talk. And so every day people will approach me with either things I haven't considered, things I've considered a lot and love talking about, but it's always very, very surprising. In addition, however, I also have exhibitions I'm working on. You know, we have a nice 5-year exhibition plan. And because footwear is not as well researched as many other aspects of culture, all the research that I do is principally primary research. So I'm delving into historic documents and trying to uncover the truth about, if you want to put it that way, the truth about how things were worn, to the best of my ability. I work with other scholars quite a bit. And so it's a mix of research, answering queries, and then also because I am the director of the museum, the creative director of the museum, it's also finances, you know, is the heating and cooling system working?
All that stuff.
So the slightly less interesting
stuff. Apart from today, obviously, what has been the most memorable day that the Battersea Museum has ever provided for you?
Oh, I would say that one of the most memorable was when it became clear that we were going to be able to do an exhibition on the history of Renaissance chopines. Oh. I don't know if you know what a chopine is, but they were these platform shoes that were worn in Southern Europe. And in Venice, they reached the highest extant example is 54 centimeters in height.
Whoa.
And they were a completely under-researched form of footwear. And I unraveled how and why they were worn. And I desperately wanted a pair of the really, really high ones from Venice. And the day that the courier brought them to the museum from Venice, and I got to actually see them in real life, was amazing. That was truly amazing. These chopines have inspired, like Lady Gaga, of course, was inspired by these. Wow. And so that was a memorable moment. I think another moment was when the sneaker exhibition opened at the Battersea Museum. The thing that was most touching to me was that, you know, I obviously love what I do. I love shoes. I love to explain how shoes work. And so I write a lot of text and I try to put in a lot of contextual imagery. And, you know, museum audiences who come to the museum are quite engaged. But when we open the sneaker exhibition, I have never seen a group of people come into an exhibition and spend that much time, look at every single shoe and read every single bit of text that I wrote.
Wow.
And I thought,
oh, that's fantastic.
These are the best museum goers I have ever seen in my life. And I really, it was very, it actually was very moving for me. Yeah. And I realized, I mean, I had known it before, but it really was drilled home to me that sneakerheads are by nature historians.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah. Jace does as well, of course, because he's explored it extensively.
Definitely. When it comes to the sneakers, then, Elizabeth, I mean, what are some of the most interesting ones for you in the collection? I mean, there must be loads, but are there any that have particular interest to you?
Well, this is something that is surprising to a lot of people. When Mrs. Bada was collecting, she never really collected sneakers. And right. One of the reasons why I wanted to do the sneaker exhibition was to expand what the museum was focused on. Uh-huh. Now, she did collect early sneakers. So we have, you know, the original Keds Champion from 1916. We have a pair of Goodyears from 1890. Wow. We have some Beacon Falls, which is where Converse got his start in the rubber business. We have a sweet little pair of Beacon Falls kids sneakers. We have some Fleetfoot. But we also had the original Instapump Fury. Uh-huh. We had the RS, the original RS computer shoe from Kavanaugh himself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had sort of these touchstones, but we still need to increase our sneaker collection. So recently we were able to acquire a pair of 1985 Air Jordan 1s.
Oh, wow.
A number of the companies have been very kind and have been donating pieces. So we have the Nike Reimagined collection. We have Bobito's given us some of his Puma Suedes, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He did a pair of Puma Suedes like 2-3 years ago.
Yeah. Yes, correct. Yeah. So we are still working on increasing the sneaker collection that we have. Now, having said that, though, there are many, many sneakers on my wish list.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should talk.
Yeah.
Maybe I can help you out. I mean,
yeah. Maybe you could.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's looking kind of crazy.
Serious.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah. I see. Actually, I think you could get rid of. So we should definitely talk.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Bobillo should give you his Air Force Ones as well, though. He should.
Oh, I know. We've had them on view.
He just doesn't want to part with them, does he?
He can't let go.
Bobillo gave us his Bada Wilson. Wooden.
Oh wow.
And those were super rare, right? Yeah. And so that was such an amazing gift.
Yeah,
and he lent the franchise, his Nike franchises, to the exhibition. And so he's always been very generous.
Fantastic.
Do you have to go like Magnum PI, Indiana Jones, trying to discover and scour the earth for, like, you know, footwear artifacts, like sneaker artifacts?
Like, you'd think it would be easy, but yes, it's true.
You can't just go on eBay.
Do you have a sidekick? You know what I mean? A witty sidekick you can, you know, riff off.
And one of the things that I want for the museum is I really want the originals, right? It's like, I we have a couple pairs of Adidas Superstars, but we don't have them from 1969. That's part of my challenge. It's like, I could just get a Foamposite, but I want the original Foamposite.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a pair of original Foamposites.
Good. I think you might have my number as well now.
I may well do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I bought the Foamposite when it came out. I was like, I went to the store and I was just like, what are those? They're bananas.
Yes.
I was like, I didn't even know how I'd actually envisage being able to wear them, but because they were just so crazy, I bought them. The price tag was crazy as well, but I was like, yeah, I got to have them. And I've still got them. Yeah, they've still got them. I think I only ever wore them once.
Even better.
Yeah.
I'll give you my number again.
All right, let's communicate. No, I've got a few things.
You'll get full credit, right? You know, always be generously donated by, and you know, we can talk about how to make this work.
we'll talk. We'll figure it out. You know what I mean? But yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I have that needs to be archived.
Sounds like a good home for me.
We have the best environmental protections and LED lighting, and yeah.
That's a really good point, Elizabeth, because Kish and I both know, because I think Kish has had some horror stories. And I remember having been to a few archives. I remember going to the Adidas archive and one of the guys there opening the box and this shoe just kind of like turning to dust.
Correct.
How do you look after these shoes? Because I mean, Kish knows even better than me. You've got this kind of whole era of sneakers, which
correct
are now just falling to pieces.
Like once you hit the 1980s, it's yeah. just mm. everything turns to dust. And I was speaking to a bunch of Nike people, yeah. and I was taking them through the collection, and I actually ended with a tailwind, which was basically dust at the bottom of a bag. And I said, you know, we are the footwear industry is being called to task for the fact that so many shoes get discarded and are just ending up in landfills, in oceans. And so I know that there's this huge amount of pressure to make sure that footwear moving forward is environmentally friendly, that it biodegrades. But as a historian, how am I to preserve the history that's being made yeah. when even before this initiative to make sure that the shoes disintegrate and go away, that the shoes were already falling apart because of the innovative new materials that were being used. Right. And so it is a huge problem. And we are lucky to have a full-time conservator who is working on plastics, how to preserve them, all the different materials that go into making things like sneakers, to find out if it's, you know, do you freeze them? Do you put them in no oxygen? Like, what is the way to preserve them? Because there is no denying that sneaker culture is central to culture today. And so in 100 years, people will need to be able to see these things.
Exactly.
And how do we hold on to them? Like, it will just be a shame if the only thing people will have access to are photographs.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I mean, basically the companies back then, they were just making shoes for the now to be
of
run
course.
And run into the ground. They didn't know correct. If the glue was going to, you know, disintegrate, or if the glue was going to harden, or what was going to happen. They weren't concerned about that. It was all about the now and making sure that the now is so well considered that the athlete can perform to the highest of their ability.
Yeah, and you know, even if you you asked about the oddity of having a shoe museum, right? I mean, even the cultural concept of studying footwear, of having that be something that's worthy of preservation, worthy of investigation, is newer than the new materials that are falling apart, right?
That's it.
We do have to figure out a way to preserve this history.
No, totally, because you know, I skated in how many shoes, I played basketball, played football in them and everything, and had I known now, you know, what I know now back then, it might have been a whole different story. But I'm just like, oh my god, my Air Trainer SCs, why did I skate in them? And that's like got a massive thread up the side when I ollied and everything, you know. It's crazy. But it's a massive thing. But I mean, you're making advances in that field of study, though.
Yes, correct. Yeah, our conservator is excellent.
Yeah,
and so we will get there, I think. And certainly other technologies such as 3D scanning, 3D printing, these two will help us preserve at least models of the shoes. But we still haven't found the secret exactly to the preservation. And
maybe preserve them in amber.
Preserve them in amber, yeah.
I saw Jurassic Park. I know how it goes.
But it does also make me worry about people who are investing in sneakers.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah. Right?
Agreed.
And so, you know, I see so much money changing hands as people try to collect sneakers. And I keep thinking, you're buying a bottle of wine that's already corked.
That's it.
And so I think I worry about that as well.
Yeah, no, I'm of the same ilk. That's an issue. I think it's a pressing concern, but it's something that you know, when there's a massive secondary market, and we're talking billions of pounds, billions of dollars at stake here. It is definitely a concern that, you know, requires more research and even scientific research. Come up with solutions and, you know, to the problem.
And the challenge is not just, you know, we maybe we would come up with a solution for storing them.
Yes.
But that's different than displaying them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so if you come up with a solution like freezing or something like that, where you get to preserve the object, but how do we then also create a situation whereby we can put these objects on view?
That's it. Maybe surround it with inert gas, encapsulate it, surround it with an inert gas so that, you know, that basically doesn't react with the chemicals involved.
Well, they did that with at least that was the original plan for the ruby slippers at the Smithsonian. So I think there are three or four pairs of ruby slippers that were worn throughout the filming, and they have one pair. Uh-huh. And all of the little sequins were starting to completely degrade. And so the conservator went through and she cleaned every single sequin, and they at first thought that they would put it in a nitrogen filled showcase, but the cost was too high.
Oh,
really?
And so they came up with another solution whereby the pressure inside the case means that air only goes out, I believe, only goes out, not comes in. But I mean, the costs were so prohibitive.
Yeah.
We need cheaper solutions for the rest of us.
Yeah, totally. And solutions probably that use less energy to store them as well, with the way that things are going.
Correct, yeah.
You're listening to Soulful Sneaker Stories, a Soho Radio original.
Elizabeth, you mentioned the out-of-the-box exhibition there, which was, I mean, it was so groundbreaking at the time. So what was it? What was happening at that time which inspired you to do the exhibition?
So the real answer is that one of the things that it still drives me crazy, but it was really driving me crazy, was in the first decade of 2000s, people, even scientists, were suggesting that women were biologically predisposed to loving shoes. And by shoes, they meant high heels.
Right.
Men were biologically predetermined to love seeing a woman in high heels, and women couldn't control themselves around high heel purchases. That they were all shoeaholics, and that this was a defining feature of femaleness. And one, given the research I was doing showing that heels started out being worn by men, and knowing that it was simply a mutable object that was given cultural meaning, I knew this could not be true. Mm-hmm. And then I thought it was a little rich that people who were saying these things, doing these studies, were not considering people collecting sneakers, who generally were men. And so I thought, maybe I could pivot my attention and look at sneakers and shifting constructions of masculinity. And so Out of the Box really did focus on sneakers and masculinity. And it was in part a retort to these comments that were being made about women in high heels.
Oh man, that's dope. That is dope. So what was the first sneaker that you went after and procured yourself personally for the museum?
I called Run DMC.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
That's a great first call.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That was the absolute first thing. I was just like, I cannot do this exhibition if I cannot get their participation.
Yeah.
And so they were very kind. Eric, their manager, was like, yep, you know, we're in, Daryl's in. And so they lent a pair of autographed superstars, the anniversary superstars.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, I can do this. Mm. But it was the most complicated exhibition I've ever done. In the end, we had over 38 lenders. And so that in and of itself is can create quite a circus. Mm. But the thing that I still to this day, you know, I've already spoken about the fact that the audience who came to the exhibition was so engaged, but I also have never, ever interacted with such a generous group of people. Everyone was excited to lend to the exhibition. They were forthcoming with information. You know, I had a small advisory group. It was just a great experience.
Oh, that's brilliant. What was the shoe that you had the greatest response from within the exhibition?
I don't know that there was one that was most popular, but there was one that caused the most consternation. And that was, I had a Converse three-striped running shoe.
Okay.
And it was a Converse, right?
Yeah.
And a few people were like, "You got it wrong. That's Adidas." And,
no,
and
I've got a basketball shoe that's like that. It's a Converse with three stripes.
I remember seeing adverts.
That's before the three stripes were copyrighted.
Exactly. That's right. And so that provided that was sort of a fun way of interacting with people. I thought that was also a really successful part of the exhibition.
No, totally. What was your particular favorite that you know that you was like, "Oh, I wish I could take this home with me."
They're somewhat controversial, but I really did love the LeBron James Stewies, and they felt so Liechtenstein-y, and some people loved them, some people hated them. I was very, very glad to borrow from Tom Sachs.
Ooh.
And he was very gracious, and so he sent me the prototype boots and as well as the original Mars Yard, because I know how every shoe came into the exhibition. I don't know that I have a favorite because each one came with such a great story, right?
The diplomatic answer, yes.
Well, I mean, of course, the Run DMC shoes will remain top of the list.
Yeah. Well, did Run DMC, going back to that, did Run DMC just give you the shell toes, or did they give you any more of their shoes that they did? Because they had a whole line with Adidas.
Right,
no. The Browns, and they had the, you know, the
Elrodos.
Yeah,
the Ultra Stone.
I only had a small amount of space to cram everything into. And so I borrowed the pair directly from Eric, and he, Ron and Daryl signed them. And so it was the anniversary shoes.
Yeah.
And then Eric and Daryl came to the opening at Brooklyn.
Wow. So let's get this straight. Yeah. Run DMC willingly and gladly donated shoes to the exhibition.
No. Drake, they lent.
All right. and yet the hometown champ, Drake, has not given anything. Not even walked through the door.
I'm not saying that at all.
I'm just trying to be controversial here.
No. Let's not start a controversy. So Drake has in fact donated a pair of the 10s, I believe.
Okay.
Also gave me some images for the collab book. He's definitely towed his weight. So don't worry about it. He's definitely been very kind.
I'm a hip hop dude. I just like trying to, you know.
You just like to stir it up, don't you?
Yeah, stir it up a little. Something,
yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
So talking of collab, Elizabeth, I was going to ask you, because obviously, I mean, collabs seem to like dominate sneaker culture at the moment. Mm. I mean, what kind of inspired you, and how did you pick? Because there must be so many out there. How did you decide, which ones were going to go in the book?
So what I wanted to do with the book, and I find the study of fashion to be really the study of what we want societally.
Yeah.
And fashion often reflects these desires before we are able to see them coalesce and really understand them as a social movement or a larger social change. So I was seeing all these collabs and I was like, what is going on? And what's the history of collabs? So as you might know, in the book, I write this essay about the history of collabs. And that history of collabs is actually oftentimes, why didn't they do it here? Why didn't they do it here? So what was happening to make collaboration so important, starting in the 2000s, but really taking off most recently?
Yeah.
And I find it interesting because Western society is very focused on individualism. We love cult of genius.
Yeah.
And one of the things that sneakers was a little late to the game at is sort of allowing that cult of genius to flourish. Like Tinker Hatfield is now maybe a household name, but most sneaker companies don't promote or let their designers be promoted because it's the monolith of this is a Converse sneaker. Or I'm not saying Converse doesn't allow their designers to be seen, but you understand my point.
Yeah.
And so, so then I was thinking about high fashion designers and, Christian Louboutin or, Mr. Blahnik, like their names stand for the product.
Mm-hmm.
So why all of a sudden was there this interest to have two entities named? And collaboration seems to be the best of collaborations is two entities sort of coming to the table and both getting an equal share of the credit. And so I, in some ways, was more interested in why society wanted to consume something that suggested, even if it was false, but suggested equal credit. And then I stood back and you see what's been happening politically. And I actually feel like these desires to have more than one person acknowledged is something that's now starting to play out much more forcefully in the broader culture.
Right.
And so I do think that while, yes, 100% there are hundreds of collabs that are crass commercial exercises.
Yeah, agreed.
I still think this idea of equality and collaboration is something that we are craving societally.
Well, we just generally we wish to collaborate. I mean, people just generally wish to get married, you know what I mean? And or partner up or couple up. You know, it's within our DNA, literally.
But we're seeing such a decline in that, right? People are becoming increasingly isolated. And you know, COVID, I think, has exacerbated that.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think human nature is to collaborate. And so I guess I'm standing back and asking the question, is this enthusiasm for collaboration within fashion somewhat linked to larger societal desires?
As you say, you can bring together two completely different designers or brands, but you know, what's fascinating is what they come up with. And so often, you know, they are more than the sum of their parts. And I think that's what people love about them.
Yeah. And so I wanted, you know, so I wanted to make sure that I included collaborations that created completely new forms. You know, if you think about Rick Owens, right? And Adidas, or even Yohji Yamamoto and Adidas. But I also wanted to talk about collaborations, which for me functioned a little bit more like haiku. Traditional Japanese haiku was a society, or haiku societies were societies in which members absolutely knew the history of haiku poetry. And when a member did sort of a small little twist on a poem, everyone would be like, I see what you did there. And so you also have that happening with retros or people who will work with a pre-existing model and add that little haiku twist to it. And so I wanted to make sure to cover sort of the range of collaborations, but I also really wanted to have collaborations that carried narratives. I think one of the other things that's so interesting about sneakers is that we have expect sneakers to tell stories, to tell narratives.
Absolutely.
We don't expect this necessarily from a pair of high heels or a sweatshirt. And so what I'm also very interested in this push too, to having stories, Easter eggs, be embedded into the footwear, and what this says, I think how we are getting smaller and smaller and smaller places to live, and I feel like it's putting these pressures on us to convey through what we put on our bodies more and more about who we think we are through the brands that we choose, through the narratives that are. Footwear, clothing are saying, and that we can assemble them to create these really complex, not even fashion statements, but fashion paragraphs to try to express who we are. And I think sneakers are sort of leading the way for that.
Absolutely. Wow, that's some deep business right there. I'm with you on that, Elizabeth. I'm with you. You know, if you're going for mayor, I'm voting for you. Do you know what I mean? Even though I'm here in London, you know.
Was there one pair that you kind of think encapsulate all of that in a way? Was there one that for you is all of
that? I could always have an answer like this ready. I find the Nigel Sylvester Air Jordan 1s that Frank Cook did really interesting, because they did a number of things. One, Nigel Sylvester became famous, you know, the first BMX rider to get a sneaker deal, but he also becomes famous because he wears a GoPro, right? And so when you're watching him bike, it's like you're him.
Yeah,
everything's his POV.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was really clever that Frank had asked Nigel to send him a pair of his worn sneakers because BMX bikes don't have brakes. So he uses his sneakers as part of what it is that he does.
That's true.
And Frank saw that the sneakers got worn out in different ways because of the way that he had to brake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were personal to him, weren't they? And his style.
Personal to him. And so when they made the sneakers, Frank used Nigel's sneakers as the basis, right, for the design. And then the sneakers kind of became, again, a kind of POV, right? It's like you're wearing Nigel's sneakers the way Nigel would wear them. But in addition, because Frank Cook, he's also the one to make the no resales, he has some feelings about the resale market. Because each and every one of the Nigel Sylvesters was hand-distressed, it also disrupted the resale market because you couldn't tell had they actually been worn by the person who bought them. I thought that those were a really interesting sneaker to put in the book because I thought that they were doing interesting things for the consumer. They were doing interesting things in reaction to the resale market. Yeah, there you have it.
Wow, that's mad.
You mentioned, Elizabeth, that your next book is on the subject of women and shoes. In terms of sneakers, where do you think the sneaker industry and sneaker culture are in terms of female inclusivity?
Well, first of all, women have always been in sneakers. It's just that they've been behind the scenes. You know, it's the same with sort of like this history of collab. There have been opportunities where women were embraced. Their ideas of female athleticism were embraced. So I write about, you know, this is something Thomas Turner also writes about lawn tennis, which was something that both men and women were encouraged, upper class men and women were encouraged to play. And then if you think about the invention of the bicycle and even the Gibson girl, I don't know if you're familiar with the image of the Gibson girl, which is sort of this turn of the century female who was seen as the new American woman, and that she could play golf and she could go horseback riding astride and she could play tennis, and that her beauty and her desirability was wrapped up in her athleticism. You know, even when Naismith invented basketball in 1891, there's some suggestion, I'm still trying to prove it, that the first game was actually played by women. And certainly basketball became huge within the United States and women's colleges immediately. Mm-hmm. And so there were all of these ideas about that did not have conflict between female desirability and athleticism. Mm. But that gets changed dramatically after World War One. World War One, and I talk about this in Out of the Box as well, was a war that science had created. Innovation in science had created a way of killing more people and wounding more people than the world had ever seen. Mm-hmm. And then medical science helped save some of those bodies. But the fragility of life was so clear. Mm. And then the fragility of the peace was so clear that pretty quickly, you see it emerge much more in the 1930s, but eugenicists begin to try to perfect the human body or decide what is the perfect human body. And so, you know, I've argued in Out of the Box that the sneaker becomes democratized during the height of fascism, because fascism asked all of its citizens to exercise.
Right.
But women and ideals of femininity begin to become in conflict here. And so athleticism for women starts to be focused on making women thin and attractive, not competitive and athletic. And I would argue that the ramifications of this remain with us today. It's like Serena Williams, you could not have a more phenomenal athlete. Yet people are not lining up to wear her signature shoes.
Yeah.
Yep. Why not?
Yeah.
Because of these complicated ideas that we have about femininity, desirability, and athleticism. So this is one of the threads that I'm looking at in this book. But then also, fashion and constructions of desirability have been linked to things like high heels. You know, one of the questions I had about the high heel early on was, why is the naked female body in men's erotica almost always ornamented by a pair of high heels? Like, you know, when I get undressed, I take my shoes off first. You probably do too. and so what is the high heel doing? What work is it doing in these images, right? We can go on another podcast. I can tell you that whole story. But the reason I bring it up is that increasingly within men's erotica, I'm seeing women in sneakers.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of Instagrammers. The girls got hardly anything on. They got a pair of kicks on. I'm just going like,
exactly.
Face palm. I'm like, seriously.
But what that's suggesting is that really decades old stumbling block about ideas of women in athletic wear being desirable is being challenged.
There's that classic image of the tennis skirt half inched up, you know, and the girl touching her bum. Do you know what I mean?
That's
one that absolutely. And certainly, you know, like aerobics, like the freestyle.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But having said all those things, I think the biggest challenge for women in sneakers, and this is a really difficult one, is that in the West, when women begin to do things that are, which are historically male, men tend to run. So like teaching used to be a male profession and now it's a female profession. We're seeing it with lawyers. The more women, female lawyers there are, the less male lawyers there are.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, I don't feel it so much at the street, at the sneaker culture level. I feel it's a question maybe happening in boardrooms, which is probably within those boardrooms, they know they have a good deal with men purchasing sneakers. What's the risk of allowing women in? You'd think that allowing women in increases the financial gains.
Yeah.
But if it's seen as being feminized, then you can see where we have a problem. Yeah.
Well, the hip hop is doing its darndest to just keep it like that. Do you know what I mean? You know, and just like, yeah, and hip hop obviously is a very testosterone driven.
And it's basketball. Although look at what the WNBA is doing.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And I do think that at the sneaker culture level, so many of the sneaker guys just don't care. They just love if somebody.
I just love sneakers. I don't care.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the Serena Williams kicks. I want a pair. I wouldn't mind. I don't. Yeah. You know what I mean? I think the colors are great. Sometimes I look at the girls' colors and go, they look so much fresher than the dudes' colors. So I want to get the girls' ones.
And
I mean?
In fact, one of the things too that's a little historic is that typically women's fashion will borrow from men's fashion, but men's fashion does not borrow from women's fashion, with the exception of some sneakers.
Yeah.
Right. That's like true. When Rihanna came out with the Puma Creeper, I mean, obviously it's based on a men's shoe, but men lined up, they also wanted it.
Yeah.
That
was a great looking shoe.
These are, they seem subtle, but these are actually seismic changes.
Absolutely.
And so if boardrooms can breathe a sigh of, you know, actually times are changing, then maybe we will have more inclusivity for women.
I know people are couples through their love of sneakers, you know, and they appreciate them together, you know, and they're like,
I've seen
couples.
So many times, you know, I use this example a lot. I was in a, you know, back when we could fly places, waiting to go through security, and there were four guys in different places in the line, and each one had a really, like, I was just like, what the hell's going on? Each one of them had a really interesting pair of sneakers on. And of course they didn't know I knew anything about sneakers, and they each started talking to each other. And it was such an interesting, clear way to break the ice.
But the thing is, talking about women in sneakers, you know, and you know, the fact that it's, you know, it's growing and it should grow, etc. What is your favorite pair of sneakers?
Oh my God, I don't have a favorite pair of sneakers. This is my problem in life. I work on footwear.
Yeah.
And what am I wearing right now? Bare feet.
What?
And so
I've got bare feet as well, but you know. But
I don't have time to shop for shoes.
And no sneaker companies are hooking you up.
I can't do that. I can't do that. I'm a historian. And so yeah, I don't have a favorite pair of sneakers.
If you could own a pair of sneakers, which ones would they be?
Oh God, I'm not even answering the question. You can't make me.
Controversial. You're far away from me. Oh my gosh. You know what I mean? It was going to be headline news, you know, Battershoe Museum curator hates sneakers. On her
refuses to choose them.
I wear sneakers all the time, but I'm not saying anything.
Okay, what about your sneaker rotation then? What's currently in your rotation? You go to the shop, what are you putting on?
I have been saving a pair of Kenzo Manamis that I have. I've been waiting for good weather to wear those. I do have a very, Chantel might not like this, very beat up pair of Chantel Martins that I wear quite a bit. And what else do I have going on? I also have a pair of Vivier sneakers.
What are those?
So Roger Vivier is a French shoe designer who was the shoe designer for Christian Dior in 1953 to 1963.
Wow.
And I've written two books on him, and he's I've been very interested in his career. And so the brand relaunched in 2002 and they started to come out with sneakers, I don't know, maybe 2013, 14. Mm. And I have a really old pair of those I wear all the time.
Wow.
I just felt like it blended both of my interests. Yeah.
It sounds like you shouldn't be wearing them. You should be putting them in the museum.
Yeah.
you shouldn't be getting high on your own supply.
You're asking me which shoes to wear. I tell you, then you tell me I can't wear them. You see my conundrum here? I just need to be wearing like a pair of flip-flops, and then everyone will be happy.
A pair of Converse All-Stars, you know what I mean? A pair of Stan Smiths, you know?
I have a pair of Vince Dupont Furies. I do love those.
Stephen Smith would be proud.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I love
What a Stephen. Legend. Yeah, what a legend. What he's doing with Yeezy.
I know. He is. I'm doing another book I'm working on simultaneously. God help me. It's called Future Footwear.
Oh.
And I'm looking at innovation within the footwear industry in real life, but I'm also doing virtual footwear. Ooh. And so anyway, Stephen doesn't know this yet, but I'm going to interview him for the book.
Stephen, you've heard it here first. Elizabeth will be reaching out via traditional channels, but just so you know.
I've interviewed him before, for the history of the Instant Pump Fury and everything. Yeah. He's a great guy.
Before we go, Elizabeth, you mentioned the books. When can we expect those to be coming out?
I need to write them.
Okay. Watch
Future
this space.
Footwear should be out in May 2022. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm doing an exhibition on that as well. And so it should open. It will cover more than just sneakers. I'll be looking at 3D printing and high fashion and all kinds of issues related to what footwear can be moving forward. I will also be looking at some innovations in the past because in many ways, sneakers in particular have been at that forefront of innovation.
Right.
And that should be May 2022. If I can, and all of the women that I'm interviewing for Women in Sneakers are very eager and willing to do it right away. I would like Women in Sneakers to come out the spring 2022 as well, but it might not come out until the fall.
Cool.
I'm writing as fast as I can.
That's good.
Well, if you need any help, Kish and I are here. So yeah, just give us
Well, I do need some sneakers. So I'll give you my mailing address or the museum's mailing address.
Yeah, so any sneaker brands out there, right? The address is Elizabeth Semowak, Bata Shoe Museum, Toronto, Canada. Right, can't be any. What's your shoe size?
No, I can't do that.
What's your shoe size?
My shoe size is an enormous size 10. Women's size 10.
Okay, so UK 7.5. Okay, women's size 10, UK 7.5. Okay, you've got the information. Women in need, right here.
Well, thank you guys. Thank you so much.
Yo, Jace, wow, what a lady Elizabeth Semowak is. I mean, seriously, the things that she's done and, you know, the level of knowledge, but it's also her reverence and the diligence that she applies to her role and the fact that she wants to, you know, tell all these stories about shoes. It's absolutely fantastic, don't you think?
I think that's it. You know, what she doesn't know about the history of shoes and sneaker culture probably isn't worth knowing.
Yeah.
And I think the way that you know, she came in, as she said, you know, she wasn't admittedly into sneakers, and the museum didn't even have much of a sneaker collection. But, no. you know, the way that she's embraced sneakers, and the way that, you know, not just at the museum, but in her writing as well, it shows that, you know, sneaker culture really does have a place in...
Absolutely.
It's had a really important place in shaping fashion, art, sport, and society.
Exactly.
And that, you know, I sometimes think people are quite cynical about it, but it, you know, I think Elizabeth in many ways shows that it is really worthy of the kind of passion and devotion that that we and millions give to this thing that, you know, in a way, sneaker culture doesn't really encapsulate what it's all about.
No, that's very, very, very true. Absolutely, very true. And, you know, she's a visionary in that regard, because she, you know, she saw something and she's like, hold on a second, she identified something and was like, okay, cool. And it's one of those sort of things where no one knew what they were missing until they were told and shown that they were missing it.
Exactly.
It's definitely a case with this. You know, when Steve Jobs gave us the iPad, everyone was like, well, you don't need this. And it's like, oh, yes, we do. And we do need the iPad. I don't have an iPad, by the way, but I need to get one. But that's another point, another problem altogether. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. But anyway, that's it for another episode. Thanks very much to all you peeps for listening in, because without that, there's no point in Jace and I being here. And remember to send your comments and questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast, where we can just break it down and